There's another interesting and important information about this man, Wedgwood, and his partner, Leadbearer. I think it's worth it to note here on page 349, it reads, Matthew had heard rumors that Wedgwood was going to Chicago to get reconsecrated by Valete. That's the way I'm pronouncing his word. He spells it capital V-I-L-A-T-T-E. This is the Bishop Joseph Rene Valete. And this again is another evident contradiction that this Wedgwood, who was consecrated by Matthew, was going now to Joseph Rene Valete to get conditionally reconsecrated over again, whereas we will soon find out that Carmel Henry Cafora and also Hubert Augustine Rogers, the two men in Chacar's line of succession, were first of all consecrated by Valete, one of his successors, and then they came into the Matthew line because they doubted Valete's consecration as a bishop himself. But now let us go to the second man in the line from Matthew's up, this prince, Bishop Jolandus Burgess, who, as we've already made mention, joined the Protestant Episcopal Church on January 12, 1915. And now on page 418, we find the information that on October 3rd, 1916, this prince, Jolandus Burgess, raised Abbot William Francis Henry Brothers to the episcopate. The following day, the news prelate his sister Delanders at the reconsecration sub conditione of Carmel Henry Cafora. Now note these facts here, please. It was on October 3rd that Prince Delanders Burgess consecrated William Henry Francis Brothers. Now let's see something about his life. You find on page 413, he started life as William Henry Francis, but added his mother's name of Brothers later on. On page 417, we find that this William Henry Francis Brothers had made himself an abbot, and he was elected by the people to be a bishop. Unable to find any other prelate to oblige his desire to be ordained a priest, he immolated Father Ignatius of Lanthony and availed himself of the services of Archbishop Joseph Rene Valete. After the ordination in Chicago, Valete and Abbot Francis soon parted company, which is not surprising. And so from that we find that this prince, Jolandus Burgess, must not have questioned the ordination of the priesthood of Francis Brothers by Joseph Rene Valete. In other words, accepted that Valete had valid orders himself to validly consecrate Francis Brothers, because at least this prince, Jolandus Burgess, did not even conditionally re-ordain Francis Brothers. But what happens now? This was October 3rd that Burgess consecrated Brothers to the episcopate. And the following day, October 4th, 1916, this same Prince Jolandus Burgess conditionally consecrated Carmel Henry Cafora to be a bishop. And here's another very, very evident serious contradiction, because why would Burgess conditionally reconsecrate Cafora? Because as we read back on page 123, it is probable that in 1907, this Joseph Rene Valete consecrated Carmel Henry Cafora as Old Catholic Bishop of France or Italy. In any case, seeing that prospects were not hopeful in Europe, Cafora migrated to the USA, where in 1916 he was reconsecrated by Jolandus Burgess of the Matthew succession. And that's only part of the evident contradictions. We come down this same page on 418 then, where we were told that Jolandus Burgess consecrated Henry Brothers and the next day conditionally consecrated Carmel Henry Cafora. And it goes on to read here something that was published in the paper by the Diocese of Fond du Lac at this time. It reads, Carlton has suggested with a man starting himself as Bishop Gregorius and a wife, Don Francis, or Reverend Willie Brothers. He claims to be a bishop consecrated by Archbishop Valete and the Armenian Archbishop Serapion. Archbishop Valete states that he ordained Brothers a priest and afterwards deposed him for a cause. There is likewise a man in our country just now starting himself, Prince Elanus Burgess, old Catholic bishop. As this man says, he comes to this country at the suggestion of the Protestant Archbishop of Canterbury and was licensed to serve in a Protestant Episcopal diocese after his arrival. It seems rather indecent of him, while acting as a Protestant Episcopal minister, still to style himself old Catholic bishop. It is to be distinctly understood that no man is to be received as an old Catholic priest unless he can show faculties from the Archbishop dated 1915. According, end of the quote from that paper, according to its own story, Bishop Gregorius and the wife Don Francis, her Reverend Willie Brothers, was elected Archbishop of Metropolitan of the Old Catholic Church in America on January 8, 1917. Whatever may have happened, both Delanders and Cafora soon parted company with him, or vice versa, just as Valete is said to have done. It has been asserted that Delanders cabled Matthew not to recognize Brothers as a bishop, and there is a big important point. Delanders Burgess, who consecrated this William Henry Brothers, cabled the man who consecrated him, Arnold Harris Matthews, not to recognize Henry Francis Brothers as a bishop. In other words, this Prince Delandis Burgess is admitting, in effect, that I myself am not validly consecrated. Well, he's admitting that if I am validly consecrated, I did not do what was necessary to validly consecrate this William Henry Brothers. And yet it was the very next day that this Prince Delandis Burgess, with the help of this Henry Brothers, conditionally reconsecrated Cardinal Henry Cafora. But that's not the end of the story. Let's hear the rest now. Turning over on pages 426 and 427, we find that this William Henry Francis Brothers, on April 6, 1962, received chrismation followed by ordination in the Russian Orthodox Catholic Church in America. And having enjoyed the status of Archbishop and Metropolitan for nearly 46 years, William Henry Francis Brothers had no alternative but to accept reordination to secure union with his group of Russian Orthodox in North America. In other words, admitting again that he had to be reordained, which means he doubted both Joseph Rene Valete's powers as a bishop and that Arnold Harris Matthews or Prince Delandis Burgess were validly consecrated bishops. But now let us go on to the next man in this line of succession up to Shuckard, Cardinal Henry Cafora. And some of the information you might relate is that Cafora did not remain under the jurisdiction of Delandis Burgess for more than 3 years. After Lander's resignation, Cafora assumed the status of Archbishop of the North American Catholic Church, and Cafora consecrated over 30 men, supposedly at least, and I guess God only knows how many he ordained to the priesthood. He was very remarkable. Of all his gifts for deposing bishops he had consecrated, and he gives the history of here Hollywood. Consecrate one, depose him, consecrate him again, depose him, and maybe consecrate him again, all within 5 years' time or less. On page 430, we're told that Cafora makes himself the Pope, but very few of the supreme pontiffs, clergy, and laity were prepared to accept his infallibility, which exceeded that of Pius XI, as defined by the First Vatican Council in 1870. Goes on here to give quite a history of the man, but One part reads, Gafura appears to have consecrated multitude of strange people, so many, so strange, that a few years ago I refused to have anything more to do with any of them. Among Gafura's multitude of bishops and priests were Ukrainians, Poles, Lithuanians, West Indian Negroes, mulattoes, ex-Roman Catholic priests, lapsed Episcopalian pastors, several Mexicans, and other men whose past history did not always bear close examination. Yet nobody could say that his church was not, quote, Catholic, unquote, for it was largely made up of the flotsam and jetsam of the ecclesiastical underworld of North America, and offered a refuge for almost any cleric of any denomination who was homeless. The state of affairs reached by the early 1940s had been summed up as follows. Quote, in North America, for many decades, the picture presented of the old Roman Catholic Church has been one of the greatest possible confusion. Unquote. And elsewhere, Gafura gave yet another proof of his hatred of the papacy on February 26, 1933, when he raised to the episcopate Francisco Jose Duran of De La Vega as bishop of the state of Veracruz. So it shows that commonly Gafura had a deep hatred for the papacy, but here on page 433 is the information that pertains to us today. It tells us that Gafura was growing old, but his energy when it came to ordaining priests and consecrating bishops was unquenched. Hubert Augustine Rogers, a West Indian Negro, originally a bishop in the section of the African Orthodox Church, Joseph Rene Velete's succession, to whom Gafura had given a conditional reconsecration on July 30, 1942, and appointed Archbishop of New York, possibly to show that he was quite indifferent to the Archbishop's Baldwin's jurisdiction, became his coadjutor with rights of succession. But as might have been expected, there was a quarrel, and the aged hot-headed Neapolitan primate found another Negro, Cyrus A. Starkley, whom he had raised to the episcopate in 1944 to work among colored people in New York City and made him coadjutor. So here's another one of those, another evident contradictions. Why did not Bishop Francis K. Shuckart or Bishop Daniel Q. Brown tell us that this Henry Carmel Gafura conditionally reconsecrated with Hubert Augustine Rogers on July 30th, 1942, conditionally redid him because he'd already been consecrated through the line of Joseph Rene Velete. So here we have two men in direct line that Shuckart traces through, already coming from the Joseph Rene Velete consecration line, which means if Velete was indeed consecrated, then Bishop Francis Shuckart does not trace back to Matthews anyway, but rather he comes from Joseph Rene Velete. And this Bishop Velete's back history is kind of similar to Arnold Harris Matthews. He consecrated a number of bishops, but he himself was a very unstable man, always changing around, going from one hiding place to another. He did many strange things in joining the Protestant Episcopal Church and many other false religions. But anyway, he received the minor orders of subdeacon on June 5th, 1885, the order of deacon on June 6th, and the priesthood on June 7th, 1885. All these orders were conferred on him by Bishop Herzog, old Catholic bishop, in the old Catholic church at Brene. In other words, he was ordained a priest by a bishop who came from the old Catholic line. But then he tried many various places to become consecrated a bishop. One of the first places he tried was at the hands of an episcopate bishop in the Church of Holland. Failing this, he applied to Bishop Vladimir, asking to be admitted to the Orthodox Eastern Church. Lastly, he tried proposals to the Roman Catholic bishop at Green Bay, but this bishop refused to consecrate him because of his past life. This Bishop of Green Bay, this true Catholic bishop, could suggest was that the first step would be for Joseph Rene Velete to retract publicly all of his error and heresy, and then retire to a religious house under probation, After this, it would rest with the Holy See to judge whether the orders conferred by Bishop Herzog were valid. In other words, this bishop didn't know whether they were or not. How then does Bishop Francis Conrad Schuckardt have such certainty? The NSCMRI priest, Bishop Musey, have such certainty that these orders are valid for Schuckardt. But anyway, this book tells about his life, and it comes on to tell us that concerning his Episcopal consecration, it took place on May 29, 1892. Monsignor Velletri was consecrated by three Jacobite bishops in the Cathedral of Archbishop Alvarez Julius I, that is, in the Church of Our Lady of Good Death in Colombo. And therefore we see that Velletri and I guess maybe then Schuckardt really come from the patriarchic line tracing back to Antioch. But anyway, to show how honest Joseph René Velletri is, says here, at no time did Velletri ever have a large following in Wisconsin. He claimed that they numbered between 6,000 and 8,000, but even 500 would seem to have been an exaggerated statement. And goes on to tell us that he was excommunicated formally at least twice. And one thing about all of his bad life is that at the end, he did make the effort to get reconciled to the true church, but that also has some contradictions. But anyway, it reads here on page 127, stories went around Paris that Pius XI had been prepared to allow Velletri's reordination to the priesthood sub conditione, but that he had refused the papal offer, being convinced that he was a bishop as well as a priest. The aged prelate usually attended the daily conventional mass, sitting in a remote corner of the chapel, receiving Holy Communion only on Sundays. No formal pronouncement on the validity of his orders was ever made by the Roman authorities. But it tells us that if this is true, then Rome, Pius XI, doubted that Joseph René Velletri was even ordained to the priesthood. He would have to be conditionally reordained. And certainly, as it said, there was never any pronouncement from Rome that any of these orders, including being made a bishop, were valid or not valid. And that is the same status for Arnold Harris Matthews. Rome has never decided the case. So who are we? Who is Bishop Francis Conrad Schuckardt and the CMRI priest and Bishop Musey to have such certainty that their orders are valid? Who are they to decide the case that Rome will not decide? On page 128 of this book by Peter Anson, we find out that Cardinal Mary Duval had already decided that Velletri had so commercialized ordinations and consecrations that he himself did not regard them as valid. And now I guess that brings us to the last of the men in the Schuckardt line of succession, to Daniel Q. Brown, who we find here in a letter dated September 6, 1983. Note that that was after he had consecrated Bishop Schuckardt on November 1, 1971. This has the letterhead from the Society of St. Pius X, Southwest District, Post Office Box 1307, Dickinson, Texas, 77539. It's from the Reverend Hector L. Bolduc, the Society of St. Pius X, to whom it may concern. This is to certify that between September 1st of 1973 and June 29th of 1974, an individual calling himself, quote, Bishop, unquote, Daniel Q. Brown, wrote a letter to Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre in Switzerland asking Archbishop Lefebvre to reordain and reconsecrate him as a priest and a bishop, as he questioned his own ordination and consecration. During this period of time, I answered Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre's mail, which came from English-speaking countries. Archbishop Lefebvre's answer to Daniel Q. Brown, which I myself typed and sent to him, stated that Archbishop Lefebvre would have nothing whatever to do with him. Signed, Father Hector L. Bolduc, Society of St. Pius X, Southwest District Superior. And I know from what the Reverend Thomas C. Fuey told me, Father Hector Bolick is such a liar that people didn't believe him, and that's probably why he had this letter here notarized. So it should be true. And if you doubt what he said, I suggest you simply write to Archbishop Lefebvre. I had so much information I didn't take the time to write to him, but find out if it's true by writing to Lefebvre himself since he's still alive. So I say this letter has been notarized to show that what Hector Bolick said here was true, which means then that Daniel Q. Brown doubted his own ordination and consecration. So again, how can we be so certain that his orders are valid? So all this leads to the final conclusion and summary. We know for certain one thing, none of these ordinations or consecrations are listed, which means they're all sinful. Nobody since October 15th, 1724, has been a member of the true church because they lack all the four marks, especially it's been proven they lack apostolicity. And therefore, the conclusion is to follow this teaching of the Catholic Church that if there's a doubt about the ordination, one must always assume that those orders are invalid unless it can be proved for certain that they are valid. And that is why the minute I found out even the bare minimum of these facts, I ceased to function as a priest. If you wish to find out a lot of details I did not put in at this date, obtain this book titled Bishops at Large by Peter F. Hansen. I obtained the copy by going down here to the local Southford Public Library, and they in turn looked in their microfiche interlibrary loan system. They sent the message up to Phoenix, and Phoenix obtained the book from the public library in Glendale, Arizona, sent it to me within a few days. And I'm sure you can get this system from most any public library in the United States. And I would conclude this section by referring to the Liturgica Urbi Abbat Geringer, OSB, Volume 10, Time After Pentecost, Book 1. And here on page 352, for the Monday within the octave of Corpus Christi, Abbot Geringer writes about the priesthood and his relation to Holy Mother of the Church. He writes, and I quote from his book now, "The priest is her minister. She prays, he molests the victim, and gives her prayer an infinite power. The indelible character of the priesthood, stamped by God himself in the priest's soul, makes him the exclusive depository of the marvelous, the divine power, and gives to the sacrifice offered by his hands a validity which no human power can control. But he may not licitly and lawfully make the oblation save in and with the church." Unquote from this reading from Abbot Geringer. What could be more plain than none of these people we've been talking about are in and with the Catholic Church? Therefore, any priest and or so-called bishop who offers Mass, even if they are valid, act sinfully and illicitly. And that leads us into the next evident contradiction at the request of Bishop Musian, Reverend Mark Peperonis. I went to visit the Reverend Thomas C. Fuey on November 26, 1985. And among the questions I asked are these: are the Masses of Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre valid and licit? And I asked that same question of these priests: Father Lucien, Father Macker, Oswald Baker, Vita Elmer, Noel Barbara, Lawrence Bray, Daniel E. Jones, Hector Bolick, Francis L. LeBlanc, Fidelis Robert McKenna, Francis Fenton, Comedy Paul, James Waffen, and all the priests who attended the conference that they had the previous October. I asked the same question about Bishop Francis Conrad Checo and Father Francis Maria Barnes. Now let us hear the Vicar General of Archbishop Musi give his answers, the Reverend Thomas C. Fuey.
go through that again. It said the Mass of Archbishop Lefebvre is both valid and listed.
Well, that's what I would say, yes. I wouldn't hang up on any of that stuff there. Same thing, I don't know Lucian Fulgermarker, but he might be teaching heresy.
I think he recanted on that Fenianism.
He did.
I'm not too sure. I don't know too much about the case, but I was told that by another person.
No, I didn't think he did, but anyway, he's certainly in good faith, and I don't think that I wouldn't be worried about it, particularly these days. It's so important that the Mass be there, and these I think these points they're good. They're perfectly listened questions, but I would regard his as being listened. Like, with Father Baker, I wouldn't have any question about him. What made you ask about him? Have you ever run across him at all?
I just heard a few things about him.
You haven't met him?
No.
What sort of things?
Oh, he just brought some of these sermons and things, and I heard this Paul Stribner Montana read onto a tape some of the sermons of Father Oswald Baker.
Yeah.
And I heard a tape of Mass at Downtown Market by Father Baker.
Downtown Market, yeah.
And, you know, it was a high Mass, and I was just wondering what kind of a priest he was. I thought maybe you would know more about him.
Oh, I know him. I met him, man.
And I guess you said you recommended him to be a bishop or something.
Yeah, he's a good man. He's quite a good man. No, there's nothing wrong with that. He's very staunch and he's probably the most prominent traditional priest in England, really. He's a humble man. He's a man about 70. But I hear from him, I read from him yesterday, not a letter so much, he sends along his bulletins every month. That's why I put pictures of some of them out and put them in the magazine. And that newsletter there, there's one in each one of those as a rule. No, he's all right. Baker, Yalma, sure, helps one. Barbara, likewise. Lawrence Bray, sure. I think all these from the Dan Jones, yeah.
Then there were just
Waldock, very exciting, serious doubt about him.
See if Father Dan Jones is both valid and listed then, right?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah, certainly. Hector Waldock, well, no, he's an extraordinary man. I just wouldn't go along with him in any way. But, however, he's been ordained by Archbishop Lefebvre, so there's that same little doubt there that might hang over his head. Apart from that, he's an unusual man. I don't see why he put Father LeBlanc on there. He seems all right. No doubt about McKenna or Fenton, Gomer to Powell, James Wallen. I think all those men are good. Quite good in the not only in these circumstances, but because they're quite good men in themselves. And they may have an unusual attitude to a few things and so on, but
and there was all these priests you would say had both valid and listed matches.
And there, my friend, there are a number of very evident contradictions. If you know these priests, they certainly are not in and of the Catholic Church. For example, he mentioned that Hector Baldick, ordained by the Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre, according to the logic then of Father Fouy, Bishop Mussy's Vicar General, that would include the same for every priest ordained by Lefebvre. His masses are valid and listed. So in the Reverend William Welch came to visit the Post Falls area, all the members of the Reverend Chaplain Church could go and attend the masses of the Reverend Welch. Did he come to Mount St. Michael's and offer his valid and licit masses? Father Francis L. LeBlanc is a priest who flies to Rome two or three times a year to visit personally John Paul II. He even sends out a little paper. He was just spoke to impart the blessing of John Paul II to his so-called friends and parishioners. In other words, Father LeBlanc is a definite JP2 supporter, and yet this Reverend Thomas C. Fouy said that if I was not to offer Mass, I and my family would be under pain of mortal sin to go up to Phoenix
a suburb every Sunday or day of obligation to attend the Mass of this Father LeBlanc and receive sacraments from him, a very evident contradiction. There's Francis Fenton and Daniel E. Jones, both very great supporters of the John Birch Society, which we know are all members of the Brotherhood of High-Ranking Freemasons, a very evident contradiction. And you probably know about some of these inner priests, which maybe they are. Well, in a conversation, as Father Fui said, that the Mass is even now, the time we had our talk at least, the Bishop Francis Conrad Shepherd and the Reverend Mark Barnes, alias Father Francis Maria Barnes, were both valid and listed. And that brings us to a number of other evident contradictions, but let me turn to a letter dated Feast of Corpus Christi, June 21st, 1984. It has been signed by Well, Reverend Father Dennis Philomena Marie, CMRI, Vicar General. This, of course, is his Big Six Breaks letter he typed up when he had his break with Francis Conrad Shuckart. And on this page five of this letter by the Reverend Robert Chicoine, he speaks about absolution of an accomplice and sins of impurity, and it reads, "One of the most severe sentences in the canon law of the Catholic Church is reserved for a priest who attempts to absolve an accomplice in his sin against the Sixth Commandment. This crime carries a penalty of excommunication, laete sententiae, which is most especially reserved to the Holy See. To incur this penalty, a priest must commit a sin of impurity with some other person and then attempt to hear the confession of that person. If such a crime occurs, the absolution is invalid, and the minister incurs the excommunication, laete sententiae. A, I have in my possession a statement sworn under oath from a young man who claims that he was seduced by Bishop Shuckart, that he was used by Bishop Shuckart for immoral purposes, and that afterwards Bishop Shuckart heard his confession. In my opinion and that of the priests and clerics that I consulted, Bishop Shuckart clearly has incurred the penalty of this crime. B, I know from the statements of Bishop Shuckart's curanades that some of these young men are currently involved in sins of impurity with him, and I also know for a fact that they are accustomed to confess to Bishop Shuckart, not to any other priest. One of these young men who told Father Mary Benedict that Bishop Shuckart told him he may not discuss this matter of confession or counseling with any other priest or superior." And so here then is a very evident contradiction. This Reverend Robert Chicoine, in this letter and in his tapes, makes it very plain that Bishop Francis Shuckart incurred the penalty of excommunication automatically, reserving the most special way to the Holy See. And yet, what does he do? He signs this paper, this letter, the Reverend Father Dennis Fetterman Marie, CMRI. How can there be a congregation to Mary Magdalene, Queen of the Universe, when it received approbation from a bishop who was excommunicated? We've already covered in the former tape which bishop should I follow. Well, bishops who are excommunicated, according to St. Thomas Aquinas and the teachings of the true church, have absolutely no jurisdiction, no authority. He signs it as well, Vicar General. How could Francis Shuckart make the Reverend Robert Chicoine, alias Father Dennis Philomena Marie, a Vicar General, when Francis Shuckart had no jurisdiction, no authority, no office in the true church since the first time he committed this sin of impurity with an accomplice and then attempted to absolve them? The Reverend Robert Chicoine tells us this took place probably not very long after Shuckart himself was consecrated a bishop. Father Chicoine was involved with this clear back in 1967 himself. He tells he knows of at least 17 men who were personally involved with this problem with Shuckart over this number of years. In other words, Shuckart certainly must have attempted to absolve an accomplice in his sins of homosexuality. Between 1970, when he was consecrated a bishop, and the day that he supposedly made this Reverend Robert Chicoine, the Vicar General, as he signs himself, a very evident contradiction. Again, I'm asking, how can Bishop Francis Chicoine himself be excommunicated and thereby not have any jurisdiction to excommunicate this Reverend Robert Chicoine and the other CMRI priests in June of 1984? How can he have jurisdiction then to make him a Vicar General? Being made a Vicar General involves jurisdiction in the external forum, and we've already explained that you can never invoke Gepakaya to obtain jurisdiction in the external forum. And to understand another major evident contradiction, let us remind ourselves of what St. Thomas Aquinas, the Prince of Theologians, says in the Summa. Not everything is known, the more by being compared with its contrary, because when contraries are placed one beside another, they become more conspicuous. And elsewhere, question 92, I answer that in Article 2. It is proper to reason to lead from one thing to another. So let us study another evident contradiction, the life of this Reverend Thomas C. Fuy, USA. When I talked to him, this Father Fuy told me he never did offer the Novus Ordo Mass, and several people from the community in Spokane had told me that this Reverend Father Fuy had been married, and that's the reason he never offered the Mass. He was not living as a priest at that time. In the 1960s, Father Fuy was a parish priest in New Zealand, where he campaigned for increasing vernacularization of the liturgy and for an end to clerical celibacy. In 1967, according to another report in 1969, Father Fuy, in common with many other priests of the day, abandoned his parish, ceased to practice as a priest, and entered a civil marriage with a local widow, becoming stepfather of three children. A priest who was lawfully ordained in the Catholic Church cannot validly contract marriage, so this Reverend Fuy was living in concubinage. For the crime of attempting marriage, he incurred automatic excommunication reserved to the Holy See, from which he has never been absolved. And how do I know that Reverend Thomas C. Fuy has never been absolved for attempting a civil marriage? Because since he supposedly repented, there's never been any authority in Rome. There's nobody in the Holy See of Rome to absolve him from this case, reserved in the most special way to the Holy See. And now let me also turn to a book titled The Busy Pastor's Guide, a translation by Reverend Oliver Dolphin of the 4th edition, and as a NACO update by William H. Agnew, S.J., and an imprimatur by George Cromwell Mundelein, April 3rd, 1924, copyright by Oliver Dolphin, 1924, Lakeside Press, Chicago. Open to page 38, it tells us under question 122, what penalty will be incurred by a priest authorized to hear confessions who exceed the limit of his powers as to reserved cases? And the answer, if he presumed himself from next communication, like they sentence any reserved, in a most special manner, or even special manner to the Sovereign Pontiff, he would incur ipso facto an excommunication reserved simply to the Sovereign Pontiff. See Canon 2388, Section 1. This tells us then that when the Reverend Thomas Fuy left this widow woman, he went then to the firm to try and get reconciled with him. And when he worked in the Archbishop of Phelps from the mid-70s up until he joined the Tuck bandwagon, if any priest of the Fulbright Church or Lefebvre himself tried to absolve this Reverend Father Fuy from this excommunication he had incurred, then that priest or Archbishop of Phelps or after themselves, ipso facto excommunicated, reserved especially to the Sovereign Pontiff. In the 1980s, Reverend Thomas C. Fuy was invited by this Reverend Hector Bolnick to come to the United States and work for the Society of St. Pius X. They worked together, I believe, around St. Mary's, Kansas. Then they had their falling apart. And this Reverend Fleury left eventually the Society of St. Pius X, as also has this Hector Baldick Bunnell. But anyway, did Hector Baldick ever try to absolve Fleury from his excommunication? If so, then it's certain Hector Baldick has another excommunication against himself or any other priest at St. Mary's, Kansas. Anyway, in about 1983, when the Took bandwagon began in the United States, this Reverend Fleury was one of the first to climb aboard, and we know now that he is the supposed vicar general of Bishop George Musey. Did Bishop George Musey ever attempt to absolve the Reverend Thomas C. Fleury from his excommunication reserved especially to the Holy See? If so, then there's another excommunication against Bishop George Musey reserved especially to the Sovereign Pontiff. A very evident contradiction arises, though, when we consider that this Reverend Robert Jacoin still accepts Reverend Thomas C. Fleury as a valid illicit priest. He sends the so-called CMRI religious to go there. They even permit people to go there to Father Reverend Fleury's place where he lives to attend his so-called seminary. Very evident contradiction. How is it that this Reverend Thomas C. Fleury has any jurisdiction left when the church automatically excommunicates him for being involved in the sins of impurity, the same way that Francis Schuckardt was excommunicated late sententiae because of his sins of impurity? How does a church excommunicate one according to the Reverend Jacoin and not excommunicate the other one? A very evident contradiction. That's not the way the true Catholic Church ever has or ever will function.
We have been reminded that Father Thomas C. Fleury, Bishop's Musey Vicar General, says that the masses of Archbishop Marcel Lefebvre are both illicit and valid. And he also told me that Marcel Lefebvre is not a heretic, and he also has never taken the abjuration of error or given the abjuration of error to anyone, although we have seen that Thomas C. Fleury worked with the society organized by Marcel Lefebvre for the years just prior to his joining with the Took bandwagon under Bishop Musey. But now let us hear what Bishop Musey says about his ideas, the same as Marcel Lefebvre's, that Vatican II is a schismatic church. This is from his talk on June 19th, 1986, and he's speaking to the so-called religious sisters of CMRI.
This same thing has happened in the church. We have people being led into a new church, a church which Lefebvre himself has correctly called the schismatic church, a church which he correctly identified as not the Catholic Church, and yet he himself is bringing these people into that church.
And here then Bishop Musey goes on to explain the evident contradictions that Marcel Lefebvre was and continues to get himself involved in. But now let us listen to the Reverend Thomas C. Fleury, Musey's Vicar General, to see how much he disagrees with his bishop. This recording was made during your evening meal on November 26, 1985.
Again, we've got to be careful. We can't just stand off and criticize everybody, you know, without any very solid foundation. We have to give a man like Lefebvre some credit for brains. He's certainly no fool. And he stands up very much for the Catholic faith as it was. And he's hoping, he has tried, I think, at least this is my opinion about him, but not everyone might agree with me, well, they don't have to. But in some quarters, you mentioned the fair when you're talking about a heretic or something else. He's nothing of the kind. He's done far more in Rome to keep this matter before the Vatican, this question of true mass, and the rights of Catholics to the true mass than anybody else in the world. Nobody else has even approached him, I think, in what he's done.
But do you think that Lefebvre still has his office as an archbishop?
I don't know, this is the point. I think he has, I would say, yeah, definitely he has, if he was validly consecrated. That's the whole point, that any doubt that is in my mind does not come from his association with the Vatican over the last few years, but with the question of Leinhardt's consecration. It's the only doubt I have about the faith personally. Bishop Musey doesn't agree with it. He has spoken out rather strongly, I think, taken up at the head of the king, against Archbishop Lefebvre. I say, well, I'm not going to be